enough understanding about special relativity and the nature of space and time to be able to do that. And this is a wonderful topic today called Einstein's Rotating Disk Thought Experiment. So some of you may know that Einstein was famous for his thought experiments. And this was a particularly important one, which played a significant role in him bridging the gap between special relativity and general relativity and putting him on the right road towards general relativity. So let's see how this works. Okay, so Einstein's rotating disk thought experiment. Okay, where's our white chalk? Okay, so here's the situation. So we got a space station here, which is floating above the surface of the Earth. And inside, we got Bob, and Bob is weightless, just like the astronauts in the space shuttle. Okay, so there he is, floating around weightless. Should we talk a little bit about weightlessness? Do you want to talk about a little bit about weightlessness? Okay, just very quickly here. So this is a famous thought experiment much earlier by Newton, where he discovered a really clear way of thinking about how objects orbit around, say, the Earth. So for example, the moon or in modern times, satellites and so on. Okay, so here we've got the Earth, and here we've got a tall mountain like this, and we're standing on top of this tall mountain, and we're going to throw objects horizontally. Okay, so first we throw it just lightly, horizontally. So the trajectory is going to go first horizontally, and then it's going to drop down like this, clunk, and it's going to hit beside the base of the mountain. Okay, if we throw it harder, then it's going to go a bit further, and it's going to go boonk down like that. If we throw it yet harder, it's going to maybe go that far, and so on. So this is a process of generalization. Okay, you start with one simple case, and you just try to push it further and further and further and see what happens. Okay, and so eventually, you know, you imagine it might do this and hit the Earth over here. Okay, so if I throw it hard enough, well, if I throw it super hard, what's going to happen is what? It's just going to basically go almost on a straight line like this, and it's just going to go out and never come back. Okay, so there's something in between throwing it lightly and throwing it really hard, so it never comes back, whereby if you throw it just hard enough, it's going to go out like this. So Newton realized that it must just go out like this and come in a circle and bang, hit him in the back of the head. Okay, and so if he moves his head aside, then it's going to go whizzing by his head, and it's going to go around and around and around. Okay, so that's just one object. Okay, that's like a satellite, or you throw a rock, or that's like the moon, that sort of thing. Now, what if you threw two objects, two rocks? You threw them basically at the same time. You threw them together, like this, like that. Okay, and so they come whipping around like this. The two of them, so here's these two, so at any point here, we've got these two rocks floating in space. They're basically on the same trajectory, just side by side. And if you're standing on one of these rocks and someone's standing on the other rock, you're basically just floating in space relative to each other. Okay, and so that's what's happening with Bob and the space station. Okay, so Bob is like one rock orbiting around the Earth, and the space station is like another rock orbiting around the Earth that are just next to each other. Okay, and so they're just hovering, they're just floating next to each other. Okay, so they're still in the gravitational field. Okay, both of them still, the Earth's gravitational field doesn't end up here. I mean, it continues like a 1 over r squared out forever, right? So they're still in the gravitational field, but they're weightless. Okay, there's that sense of weightlessness. Okay, they're on essentially the same trajectory. Okay, so now Bob here is is this, you know, engineer guy, and he's supposed to be doing useful things on the space shuttle, you know, useful experiments and constructing things and whatever he's supposed to be doing up there. And he can't very well do that if he's like floating around like weightless and stuff. So what we want to do is introduce an artificial gravitational field. How are we going to do that? spin. We're going to spin this guy. Excellent. Okay. So we're going to spin this guy at some rotation rate omega, and we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so everyone, how many of you have been on that amusement park ride, which is this great big cylinder, which is spinning around, and it's got this floor? And so as you're spinning around, so your back is to the wall like this, and you're whipping around like this, and then it feels like you're being pushed against the back of the wall like this, and then friction and all that stuff, and then they can drop the floor out on you. Yeah, this thing is fantastic. And then it actually turns upwards like this, and you're going around like that. I love that kind of thing. Anyways, so that's what's happening here. So we're going to create this artificial gravitational field by rotating. And how many of you have seen that old movie, Stanley Kubrick, 2001, A Space Odyssey? Yeah! Okay. And also, this kind of very, very simple technology might be used to get people on a trip to Mars. Okay? Because being weightless for a long period of time, what happens is your bones degenerate and all kinds of bad things happen to the human body. So the whole idea is to keep people in some kind of a gravitational field similar to that on the Earth. And you can do that by just rotating the spaceship. Okay, so the first thing I want you to be convinced of is the idea that... Okay, we'll just forget about the Earth and all that stuff, and we'll just focus on Bob and the space station here, rotating space station or spacecraft. So what we were talking about for the amusement ride is Bob basically lying on his back. He feels like he's being pressed against the wall, okay? And he's whipping around like this, around and around. Okay, now I want you to be convinced that Bob could also just stand up. Okay, so if Bob could stand up so that the inner surface of that cylinder is now his floor. Okay, his arms would feel heavy, and they would drop down like this, and he would be able to work at his little workstation and do stuff in his artificial gravitational field, and so now he's very happy. Okay, so how many of you are okay with that? Is that all right? Okay, so from Bob's point of view, he would consider this to be up. So the direction toward the central axis of the cylinder is up, and the direction towards the floor is down. Okay, so the gravitation, this artificial gravitational field, defines up and down for him, just like the real gravitational field on the Earth defines up and down for us. Okay, so we got that. So now the question we have is, we've got Bob in something which seems like a gravitational field, it's an artificial gravitational field, and the question is, how closely does that artificial gravitational field mimic the real gravitational field that would be produced by a mass, like the Earth or the Sun or a galaxy, that kind of thing. Okay, so how close is artificial to real? Okay. All right, so whenever I say real gravity, I mean that gravity due to masses. Whenever I say artificial gravity, I mean that gravity due to motion, okay, acceleration. Okay, so one experiment that we could do is Bob could hold on to an apple in his hand here. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a top-down view, looking down the axis of the cylinder and seeing Bob going around and around like this. Okay, and we're going to analyze the situation of him holding on to that apple. Okay, so let's suppose that Bob is over here. And he's holding on to an apple like that. Okay? What is the motion of the apple? This guy is spinning. The whole space station and Bob, who's holding on to the apple, are spinning around. What is the motion of the apple? Right. So the shape of the orbit of the apple is moving in circular motion, uniform circular motion. Okay, so here's the apple. It's moving around in uniform circular motion. Okay, so what is required to put something in uniform circular motion? How do you get something moving in uniform circular motion? Yeah, so uniform circular motion means there's an acceleration directed towards the center. So as soon as there's an acceleration, there's a force. Okay, so in order for this apple to be moving in this uniform circular motion, requires that there be a force acting on that apple, and that force be directed toward the center. Okay, so there's a center-directed force. Where's that force coming from? Sorry? Normal reaction? Yeah, so the hand. So Bob is exerting that force. That's where that force is coming from, right? So let's see if here's the situation. From Bob's point of view, what Bob notices is I'm standing in this thing. I actually maybe don't even know that I'm rotating. Okay, I'm just standing inside this thing. It's a sealed container, a sealed cylinder. I don't have any windows to the outside. I can't see the distant stars like this. And I can't see that I'm rotating relative to the distant stars. I just feel this weird kind of artificial gravitation, maybe not real. I feel this artificial gravitational field. I'm hanging onto an apple like this in my hand, and I notice that in this state of whatever is happening in this state, I feel like I'm pushing up on this apple. Okay, so I'm exerting an upward force on this apple. Okay, so that's exactly the same as Bob standing on the surface of the Earth. Okay, I'm standing on the surface of the Earth here, and to hold this piece of chalk, I have to keep pushing up on this piece of chalk. So I'm exerting this upward force. Okay, so far so good. So with this simple experiment, Bob wouldn't be able to distinguish between whether he's inside this rotating space station or whether he's on the surface of the Earth holding this apple. In both cases, it's phenomenologically the same. He's exerting an upward force. Okay, what if Bob releases the apple? What if Bob just drops it like this? What if he removes his hand? So this apple is whipping, so Bob and the apple are whipping around and around and around and around like this. And then suddenly, at this instant of time over here, Bob releases the apple. What's going to happen to the trajectory of the apple? Okay, it's going to move exactly tangentially to the circle. So whatever the velocity the apple had at the instant that Bob released it, it would maintain that velocity. There's now no more force acting. The acceleration stops. The velocity remains constant. It remains exactly what it was at the instant it was released. And so what will happen is the trajectory of the apple will change from a circle to just a straight line, okay? Just floating freely in space. This is just empty space. You release an apple from that point with that velocity. It just travels on a straight line like that, okay? But now, while this apple is traveling on this straight line, during that time, Bob is also still moving around, right? So by the time the apple hits the inside wall at this point, Bob will have turned around. Bob himself will have turned around so that now he's standing over here. Okay, and you'll notice that the apple hits the what Bob considers to be the ground, hits the ground right at Bob's feet. Okay, so let's see if that's the same. So here on the Earth, we got Bob. He releases the apple like this, and what happens is it just goes clunk and it hits the floor. Moreover, it accelerates toward the floor. So as it's falling, it's picking up speed faster and faster and faster. Okay, and that's actually what's happening here. So if you notice, let me just use a different color chalk so we don't get too messy here. You'll notice that initially, the initial velocity, just the instant that Bob releases the apple, the initial velocity of the apple is like this. The initial velocity of Bob is exactly the same. Okay, so the apple and Bob have exactly the same velocity vectors. What is their relative velocity? Zero. The difference of the two velocities is zero. Okay, so as far as Bob is concerned, when he releases it, for a split second, it's just has zero velocity. It's just hovering there for a split second. Okay, but then as time goes on, you'll notice that the distance between Bob's feet here and the apple gets less and less and less. Okay, the apple is not accelerating. The apple is moving on a straight line, but the floor is moving on this curved trajectory. The floor is accelerating. In fact, the floor is accelerating up toward the apple. So at this instant of time, the apple and the floor are on parallel courses, okay, and there's very little relative velocity. But by the time the apple gets over here, the floor has bent around like this and accelerated upward, and it's going slam. It's accelerating up and hitting the apple. Okay? So you can see just from this picture that the relative velocity between the apple and the floor is going to be increasing as the apple approaches the floor, which is exactly what we see here. Okay? It starts off falling slowly, picks up speed faster and faster and faster, and then it hits the floor. Okay? So far, so good. So with these two simple experiments, Bob can't distinguish between whether he's in this rotating cylinder out floating out in space, or whether he's just standing on the surface of the Earth. Okay? And for all of these things, what we're going to imagine, actually, I'm sort of exaggerating the situation here, what we're going to be imagining is that the space station is rather large compared to Bob. So Bob is actually down here. Okay, so the space station is rotating like this, and Bob and his apples and all that stuff are just this really small, on a small scale compared to the entire space station. Okay? So at least these two simple experiments indicate that this artificial gravitational field very well mimics the experiences one would have in a real gravitational field on the surface of the Earth. Okay, so are there any other tests that we could do to see how well this artificial gravitational field mimics a real gravitational field? You could throw it up. Okay, so he could toss it like this, see what happens. Okay, so it would go like that, and he would go like that. And is that a parabolic trajectory? I don't know. Okay, what other tests? What about a weigh scale? What if he had a weigh scale? A weigh scale is like a spring scale like this. You stand on that scale and you determine your weight. Would a weigh scale work the same in this rotating space station artificial gravitational field as on the Earth? What about a balance scale? So a balance scale is like this. And you stick a mass there and you stick a mass there and you adjust their whatever until it's balanced. Would that work the same? Okay, so I encourage you to sit back later on and think about this and come up with different tests that you could do to try to distinguish between this and this. Okay? Anyways, so as far as it goes, as far as we've said so far, it certainly looks like the artificial gravitational field mimics a real gravitational field quite well. So why is this significant? Well, here comes Einstein. Okay, so first of all, Einstein realized, this is after special relativity, after Einstein has realized there's a universal speed limit, and he's understood time dilation, length contraction, and all that stuff, relativity of simultaneity, he starts turning his attention to gravity. Okay? And he recognizes that Newton's model of gravity, Newton's picture of gravity, the mental construct that Newton made to try to make sense of this phenomenon called gravity, must be wrong. Okay, and there are two main reasons, two simple sort of ways to think about this. One reason is theoretical, and the other is experimental. So the theoretical reason has to do with what I just said, that there's this universal speed limit. Okay, so all physical phenomena respect the fact that information of any kind cannot be transmitted from point A to point B faster than the speed of light. Okay, so now, Newton's model of gravity does not respect this. Newton's model of gravity doesn't have anything to do with time in it. Newton's model of gravity is an action at a distance, an instantaneous action at a distance. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is, suppose that you've got the sun here, and we've got the Earth going around the sun. Okay, and according to Newtonian gravity, the Earth exerts a force on the sun, and vice versa. And the force that the Earth exerts on the sun is precisely that that center-directed or centripetal force required for the Earth to be in circular motion. Okay, that's Newton's model of gravity. Okay, now the problem with that is the force, according to Newton, the force that the sun exerts on the Earth depends upon the instantaneous positions of these two guys, okay, at the same instant. Okay? Now remember relativity of simultaneity. When you say that these two events are happening simultaneously, well, simultaneous for who? Okay? So right away, there's going to be a bit of a problem, you can see. But a simpler way to see that is, let's suppose that at one instant of time, the sun suddenly disappears. So we're a magician, and we can make the sun magically disappear. Okay, so at some specific, so here's the Earth wheeling around in its orbit here. And at this particular instant of time, when it's at this position, we suddenly remove the sun. What's going to happen, according to Newton's model of gravity, to the trajectory of the Earth? Right. The instant that we've removed the sun, according to Newton's model of gravity, the gravitational force is instantly gone. Because the gravitational force is g times m, the two masses, divided by r squared. There's no issue of time here. Okay? This is this r here is the instantaneous distance, et cetera. Okay? As soon as we pull this guy out, this force disappears. No more center-directed force. Just like the apple in the space station, bang, it takes off on this trajectory. And we would know instantly that that had happened. Because we'd look at the stars and we would say, hey, our motion relative to stars has changed exactly at that instant. Okay, so instantly this happens. But so what that means is we would have knowledge that the sun had disappeared instantly. Something happened over here and we instantly knew about it. Somehow information had made its way from here to here across this vast distance instantly. Okay, that's not possible if there's a speed limit in the universe. Okay, so what should happen, according to Einstein's reasoning, is if the sun were to disappear, then just like light, how long does it take light to get from the sun to the Earth? 8 minutes. Okay, so if a magician were to suddenly make the sun disappear, then the waves of light that were on their way to the Earth, you make the sun disappear, it's not going to make those waves disappear. Those waves would continue coming like this. Okay? And so for a full 8 minutes, we would be looking up at the sky, and we'd say, yeah, the sun's still there. Phew, that's a good thing. Okay? And then suddenly these waves would end, and we would say, 8 minutes later, we would say, whoa, something really bad has happened to us. We're in trouble. Okay? So light respects that speed limit. But gravity doesn't. What Einstein figured should happen is we've got the sun like this. Okay, the sun disappears at this instant in the orbit, and the Earth should continue on in exactly the same orbit for another 8 minutes before it suddenly realizes, whoa, the sun is gone, and then it goes off on a straight line. Okay, so there's an obvious reason why Newton's model of gravity must be wrong. It needs some kind of fixing. Okay. The second reason is experimental. Okay, and this has to do with the motions of the planets. So well before 1905 or 7 and so on, when Einstein is thinking about this, it was a well-known problem that Newton's model of gravity was running into difficulty explaining the trajectories or the orbits of the planets, in particular Mercury. Okay, so the picture is something like this. Here is Mercury's orbit. It's basically an ellipse, right, around the sun. Okay, so by an ellipse, what that means is it starts off at this point, and it comes around, and it's a closed trajectory. So according to Newton's model of gravity, if you just have these masses here, and you use this Newtonian gravitational force and F equals ma and so on and so forth, it tells you that the planet Mercury should orbit on this closed ellipse like this. Okay, but when you actually take your telescope out and look at Mercury, you see that it doesn't do that. It does something very different, okay, or slightly different. What it does is it goes almost on an ellipse, okay, almost a perfect ellipse, but it returns to a slightly different point, okay, and then it takes off again and returns to a slightly different point. Okay, so its orbit actually looks something like this. So it's like a spirograph kind of thing. How many of you have ever done spirograph? OK, Couple of you? Excellent. Spirograph. Okay. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Now, the fact is, so this is called the precession of the perihelion, or the aphelion. This is the aphelion, so the precession, but it's usually called precession of the perihelion. Okay, so anyways, the line that connects the sun to the most distant point, that line at some instant of time maybe points to this star over here. Okay, but as time goes on, the line of the major axis of the ellipse ends up pointing to a different star over there. So this axis precesses. Okay. Now the thing is, you can within Newton's model of gravity, you can actually account for some of this precession. Okay. In fact, quite a lot of this precession by the presence of the other planets. So yeah, if the solar system consisted of just the sun and Mercury, then Newton's gravity says yes, a perfect ellipse, closed curve. But if we account for the other planets, such as Venus, and so here's Venus over here, and here's Jupiter over here. These guys all exert gravitational tugs on Mercury, according to Newton's model of gravity. And that's going to disturb the orbit. And it turns out that if you account for all of the planets, then the disturbance they produce actually does this. Okay? But the amount of disturbance is not quite right. If you account for all the planets very, very carefully, you will find that the amount of disturbance in, say, one century should be the major axis should precess from here all the way over to here. Okay, but how much it actually precesses is from here all the way over to here. And there's a small discrepancy. And this discrepancy was unexplained, okay, at the time. And then Einstein came, just to make the story short, Einstein came along, developed general relativity, a new model of gravity, which actually accounted precisely, dramatically precisely, for that slight discrepancy. Okay? So that's that. So Einstein needs a new model of gravity. Okay, but where's he going to start? How do you come up with a model of gravity? Yeah.
It's too difficult. What is the space that remains?
Oh, so this space is, so the amount of the discrepancy is 43 arc seconds per century. Okay, and an arc second is, so you have 360 degrees, and then if you take 1/60th of that, 1/60th of 1 degree, that's 1 arc minute. 1/60th again is 1 arc second. So it's 3,600th of a degree. So it's a very, very small fraction of a degree. So if you were to sit there for 100 years and watch Mercury going around and around and around, you would notice a discrepancy that's like super tiny. But nevertheless, the technology by the, I think it was the 1870s or so, was sufficiently developed, the observational technology, that you could actually, this was a definite problem. The technology was easily able to see this discrepancy.
Yes.
Sorry, that wasn't the right question. I didn't answer the right question. Okay, sorry.
Is it possible to that you tell us what is the cause of this?
What is the cause of this?
Yeah.
So one way to think about it is the Newton's model of gravity, the force is a 1 over r squared. So here it is. That's the 1 over r squared. If you look at the geometry, space-time geometry surrounding a spherically symmetric object, that space-time geometry it has a name. It's called the Schwarzschild geometry. And if you take a slice, of space passing through the equator of that massive object, maybe it's the sun or the earth or whatever, and you look at the geometry in that surface, the geometry is. The geometry is warped, and I'm going to be talking about this kind of warping a little bit later on, so I don't want to get into a lot of detail. The geometry is warped, okay? And so Einstein's model of gravity is a purely geometrical theory, but you can put it into kind of a Newtonian form, and if you put it into a Newtonian form, you find that it looks like a force that's 1 over r squared plus a small 1 over r cubed correction, okay? And this 1 over r cubed correction is what makes the orbit not close. Okay, you get closed orbits for precisely 1 over r squared forces and forces proportional to r. Proportional to either r or 1 over r squared. But anything other than that, you'll get non-closed orbits. And so this disturbs that a tiny bit, and you get slightly non-closed orbits.